Hello, this is Brian Cam, and you are listening to Clear Story, a podcast which is normally a monologue in which I talk about literature, philosophy, and the history of how we know things. But this podcast is part of a series where I release conversations that I've had with people on Twitter Spaces. If you don't use Twitter or you don't use Twitter Spaces, this is just a way of hosting a live audio conversation on the internet. By default, it has a sort of host with an audience and you can invite people on stage. So this is an experiment in releasing some of those conversations which have just been sitting on my hard drive until now. So I hope you like the conversation that we had and I look forward to hearing from you. If you would like to schedule one of these conversations with me, please reach out. I am Brian Cam on Twitter. I'll include that in the show notes. And you can also find a link there to schedule a future conversation with me if you would like to do so. And with that, here's a conversation from earlier this year.
That'd be great. So I have a bunch of questions that I can ask you, but I wonder if you know where you'd like to start off, and then I can just follow along and everyone else can follow along and jump in whenever they might need clarification or elaboration or have something else to add.
Yeah, I'm very curious what questions you have for me. I think in my mind, I was like, I kind of wanted to start with that Spinoza thing on perfection. But like, that doesn't have to be right at the very start. That can be like a little bit of background into how this thread got started, I guess.
I'd love to hear the background, actually. I mean, I'm also interested, obviously, in all things about where dichotomies start and where they started in the West and how that might be very different than other ways that people think about abstractions or reality and so on. But I think you have a good sense of where you might, you know, want to start in history or historical times.
Yeah. So I guess... In a weird way, it did start with that Spinoza section from the Ethics. So the Ethics is by many, but not everyone, considered to be Spinoza's kind of magnum opus. And it comes out in 1678, like the year after he dies. And he's in Amsterdam, you know, philosophizing away. He is a Portuguese Jew who is there. They've had problems in the Iberian Peninsula, as Jews did for, you know, many times over the centuries. And he gets there, and Amsterdam at that time, I guess they've got, you know, I guess like Portugal, the Dutch have all these colonies and stuff, but it's like massive wealth flowing in. There's this huge artistic boom going on. It's like, as far as I know, it's like the place to be in like 1680 to 1700. In fact, I'm like very fascinated that, Peter the Great shows up like 1697, I think. So it's like a little bit after Spinoza dies. But it's kind of like really metropolitan, cosmopolitan, like very cool place to be, as I understand it. But it is still possible to kind of piss off the authorities. So Spinoza kind of does this in two waves. Once he gets in trouble with the Jewish community, and then he keeps going and like starts to get signs that he's going to be in trouble with the kind of Dutch Christian authorities, as I understand it. And so he has this book. It's called The Ethics. And it's like this kind of really fascinating book, because on the one hand, it's like, it is so rationalist. Like it's set out like a geometric proof. It starts out talking about God and nature, and it gives you all these axioms. Like it's literally constructed, you know, to prove that God exists and prove all these consequences for ethics. And I cannot claim to grok the whole thing. Every time I read it, I like start getting lost in the propositions because it's so self-referential. But I have a friend who knows a lot about more about it than I do. And he's like, everything that you need is in the first two pages. If you accept all of those, then you know, you're kind of stitched up. Like Spinoza has, you know, like everything else proceeds from that. And maybe you can sense why this is kind of interesting to me, because I'm very interested in like these closed rationalist systems that like are totally internally consistent, but because they make up their own, or because they get to decide their own axioms, and if you accept them, then they kind of proceed in this like inexorable way. So that's like I'm interested in it as like a high example of that, but Spinoza is also just like a insanely good writer and just an interesting person. So I got going on this chapter called Of Human Bondage. I think it's like the fourth section. And he's really interested in freedom of the will, as many philosophers are, but he is a hard determinist. He does not believe that that there's any space for free will in his kind of God is nature is the kind of famous line in the Ethics. And so in that section, it's just like a really small thing that I was reading. I don't know when it was, maybe like I guess it must have been in November because I was writing about it a little bit on the blog. And what he does is he's like, okay, everyone's obsessed with God being perfect. And he's like, well, let's look at the history of perfection. And he says, perfect in terms of the Latin etymology just means finished. So it's like a per, and I think that it's like a facere, which is like a to make or to do, if anyone has better Latin than I remember. I think it's just that. So it's basically, I assume per is like an intensifier or something like that. And so it's like the thing is just done. And so he gives this example of like a house. So a house, at one point in history, it's just done when you stop building it, right? So let's say I'm building a house and I put all the stuff that I want to in the house. And then at the end, I'm just like, okay, that's done. That's the etymology of perfect. So to say like it's perfect just means that I've literally stopped working on it. So what's interesting about that is like it's a very concrete judgment, and it's a judgment made by the kind of if you will, author of the work or the builder of the house. And so he says that it's only through seeing many perfect, as in completed houses, that we as individuals come to think of perfection as something abstract. So we think we know what a perfect house consists in. And so it's only through this big process of inference through which we forget all the individual cases of seeing this house and that house that we then come to this place where we think, oh, yeah, there's perf a perfect house. And if you see what's happened there, there's kind of been two shifts. One is that it shifted away from the concrete instance of a person building a house and finishing it. And it's also shifted from the kind of eye of the builder who's constructing the house to the eye of the beholder who has seen a lot of perfect houses. So he thinks that this is the kind of first mistake. So rather than perfect just meaning this is done by the person who's making it, it starts to mean something abstract that has these features that are not necessarily in every single instance, just with as the nature with any abstraction. And he thinks that the further mistake that we make is to assume that nature is like human stuff. So, in other words, there is a notion of perfection in nature that could be in terms of species that, before Darwin, there is this idea that all species are kind of on this orthogenesis track where they're on the way to perfection. And Darwin does use the term perfection to mean like done changing, which is also kind of interesting because it's almost like the earlier Spinozan use, or at least that's what I would argue. So I got really interested in this because there's kind of like a double mistake of first, it's almost like at the beginning, you start with two concrete things, right? There's building the house and deciding when it's done. And so the individual involved in that endeavor finishes when he's done, basically, or she is done. Now, the first mistake is to then say there's this abstract notion of what a house should be. And then this the kind of mistake on top of that is to like attribute that to nature. And then there starts to be a further issue when you start to compare things that themselves are not concrete to these abstract ideals that you've created through a process of experiential inference, but you've kind of forgotten that that's what's happened. And I think that this is like a general trend through in abstract nouns. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes complete sense. And is there nothing, maybe I'm rushing too far, but so far, is there no sense of functionality? Like, in other words, when the person who has built the house says it is done, it was there for Spinoza also a sort of functionality to that element of judgment of doneness from the person themselves, that subjective sense of perfection?
That's a good question. I think he mostly regards it. I'm not sure if he regards it as a mistake. He definitely regards it as a mistake to think that nature has a teleological, end in the sense that, we try to build houses and they are supposed to serve some function. And he very much does not think that that's how nature works. And because he equates nature with God, he does not think that that's how God works. And this is really important, this anti-teleological stance. I can go into that more later. From my point of view, it is useful to have abstract categories. And I think it's important to say that I'm not opposing that per se, but I think that one issue is that you can forget that comparisons and attributions don't really work the same way with abstract nouns as the like abstract nouns and qualities as they do with concrete ones. And I know that's going to get into could us into a lot of other issues in terms of like what is reality, which we're also probably going to have to go into. But like just to give the example that I've been thinking about lately, there's a similar you the abstraction happens a little bit later in China than it seems to in Greece. And so in the 5th century BC, there is this the questions for the Confucians are mostly like, is this specific guy, does he understand ceremony? And so you can see that ceremony has been abstracted into this kind of ideal, but they're still comparing individual guys to it. Whereas they don't enter the question of like, is human nature good or bad for like almost two more centuries until like, oh, I guess it's like the end of the 4th century. And the end of the 4th century, this is after, Socrates, Plato, I guess Aristotle's kind of finishing up around then, but definitely already in Socrates, there's very much, he's already in this realm of abstractions, and arguably the Indian philosophers are even earlier. So in that case, there's like a double abstraction, if you see what I mean. So like the question is like, is the abstract, does the abstract human, which you never encounter, of course, you only ever encounter individual humans. So you have to like form this understanding of what human nature is. Does that conform to something, to an abstract understanding of good or evil? And so the it's almost like I'm not saying that abstractions aren't useful because anytime you use a noun, even a concrete noun like a house or a tree, that is a category that, well, maybe I'll leave it there because there's many views on how that categorical element works. But does that answer your question, or is it like
No, it does answer. It does answer. And I think, yeah, you can keep going now because I think you're going to get into the categories. You just said something about it. So yeah.
So yeah, just to contrast those two. So like the question, just in grammatical terms in English, for example, like the apple is good, which is a kind of like, it's a concrete indexical thing. Like it's indexical in the sense that you can point at it with your index finger, which it so it's just something you can point at, right? And so the apple is green has the same grammatical structure as human nature is good or something like that. But in one case, usually you're talking about like a particular apple and attributing a pretty like thing that most people can kind of agree on. It seems to have this aspect of concreteness. What it means to be concrete and what it means to be real, that's its whole own topic. But I think it's important just to notice that you have to have some account of how we do abstraction, right? And so that kind of leads into this debate that it's a very long-standing one. It really goes back to the ancient Greeks, as many of these things do, and probably back to Indians, to the Indian logicians and philosophers before that. But it's central to a part of philosophy called scholasticism in the Middle Ages, and very important to an American pragmatist philosopher in the 19th century called Charles Sanders Peirce. Do you think I should go into that, or I don't know?
Absolutely. I think that the Peirce thing around how science works makes it very concrete about why this is so relevant to all of us right now.
Right. So there's kind of two categories. And the question is between what's called realism and what's called, it's not realism and idealism. This is why it's confusing, because realism means something different in this terminology. It's realism versus nominalism. And the question is one of what are abstract categories or what are universal categories? The kind of most concrete or the most extreme realists are in the vein of Plato, at least. So there's this idea that not only are the abstract categories real, but they may exist in some realm or something like that. And they are actually more real than the individual things that we experience. But like our experience, this is also why he kind of does this thing about, you know, we don't actually learn things, we just remember them because we have this memory of the world of forms or something. I'm very much not a Plato expert, so if anyone wants to jump in and correct me, that would be great. But that's so one idea is that when we, you know, we recognize the tree, it's because there's this abstract thing called tree that really exists in some metaphysical realm, and our recognition is seeing the individual one and kind of mapping it onto this abstract category. On the opposite end from this view is what's called nominalism. And nominalism says that because we only ever encounter individual things, they're actually like abstract categories are an illusion. And the extreme nominalists, arguably Nietzsche is one. It's kind of to me, unclear. Maybe again, a Nietzsche expert can come in here. But on the nominalist side, there's this view that, you know, we never encounter abstract categories, right? We only ever encounter particular things. Now we attribute to them to, you know, a color or to, you know, like house or tree or kinds of things that we've been talking about. So the nominalist view is that because we only ever encounter individual trees, there are only ever individual things out there, sort of. And the extreme position is that even within the mind, these things that appear to be abstract categories, like tree, they're actually mistakes because they themselves are individual. And so they don't refer to anything is what an extreme nominalist would say. This makes it hard to have conversations, much less do science. You get some guys in ancient Greece already doing this. There's this really interesting guy called Stilpo, who I think is there's it's all it's before a certain point, it's all just kind of rumors. So he has some connection to Pyrrho of Elis, who we may talk about later, famous skeptic who starts a very important kind of counter philosophy to Platonism, or it's really just counter to any form of dogmatism, as he calls it. And he's also related to the Stoics, which is also interesting. The Stoics are dogmatists. They believe in, you know, that the truth is knowable. I think it's called catalepsis or something like that. So Stilpo has this weird saying, which is like, any man, like anyone who talks about anyone, which is like already contradictory, right? Because he's talking about anyone, but he's saying anyone talk who says anyone means no one, because this category is like essentially an empty set, rather than being on the realist side where, you would have maybe this abstract category of people. And when you say anyone, it not only apply, it not only includes the set of all existing people, but probably also every person that could ever exist. And that category is like a truly existent thing in Plato's idea, even more existent than, the individual people that we encounter, which is all like they're both weird positions, right? And so there's kind of two intermediate positions that I want to talk about a little bit. One is called moderate realism. And this is where Charles Sanders Peirce falls in. He thinks that essences, and by the way, this goes back to a scholastic debate. So this is also where Thomas Aquinas and Duns Scotus fall. They believe that although abstract categories or universals, as they're called for the scholastics, do exist, they don't exist in some other metaphysical realm, or at least they need not, and we don't need to like really talk about whether they do or not, because they have an essence that inheres in every object. So when you and I look at an oak tree, a specific one, we both recognize an essence of tree that is kind of bridges the gap between this universal category and the individual tree. So Peirce thinks that you need that in order for there to be any laws of science or any regularities. He thinks that it's undeniable that science produces progress. Science seems to refer to something. Here it's probably worth just mentioning Duns Scotus's definition of reality. R what is real is that which exists independently of minds. So it doesn't really make a claim about whether that reality is some kind of metaphysical realm. It's just saying, like, if we both look away from the tree still exists. That most people would agree to. If we look away from the tree, like, but also that there exists a category of tree. So for them, that is real. The category is not created by humans. It actually has to pre-exist humans. So this is why what starts, what seems like a kind of like moderate realism seems like it makes sense, like a good position to have. But then you realize that it kind of requires any essence that eventually exists to exist first in potentiality. And Peirce talks about this. So he basically thinks that, maybe typewriters didn't exist at the start of the universe, but they had to exist in this kind of in principle, even if they didn't exist in a abstract realm, there was some pre-existing essence of typewriter, which I find super weird, but that's the moderate realist position. And finally, the fourth of these positions, so the hardest one is kind of Platonism, or what Hilary Putnam calls metaphysical realism, but the harder version is, I guess, this idea of Platonic forms. Then there's moderate realism. Then I've already talked about the far end, which is nominalism. And between moderate re realism and nominalism is a thing called conceptualism. And that's the understanding that universal categories do exist, and they exist in this kind of well, there's different people who would say different things about this. This is a view also comes about, it for sure exists in the Greeks, but it's not articulated quite this way. The scholastic philosopher that's most associated with it is Abelard, who's much more famous for having an affair with Heloise, his insanely brilliant, beautiful student, and then having her uncle send guys to castrate him than he is. At least that's how I knew about him anyway. But apparently he was a super brilliant philosopher. I'm only learning that late in life, I guess. So conceptualism is the idea that universal categories do exist in this kind of human mind realm, and we apply them to the individual things that we encounter. But they're kind of like a they're a map onto a territory, it's a kind of directional thing. So we are not recognizing essence of tree that pre-exists us and all things when we both recognize the same tree. In the conceptualist's view, tree is, the category of trees is formed on the basis of inference and of experience. And then we refer to the kind of, this category that it is ultimately a human construction. Now, people like Peirce see this as essentially identical to nominalism, because it means he thinks that it prevents physical laws from existing and things like that. I don't really know how to solve this problem. That's about as far as I've gotten to on this aspect, is that conceptualism seems like kind of the least problematic. I don't know, to
I'd like to open it up to anyone who might have some input. I'm just going to ask you one quick question before that, and if you think it takes you off track, then ignore it entirely. But what I'm wondering is if all of these conceptualizations have as their base that these things are that you are basically born, the nativist sort of approach, that you're born with these concepts or this ability, rather than what I thought you were saying with the last one, the conceptualism, I guess, that there is an intersubjective level where you're basically socialized into this world of understanding these essences in agreement with in a social context.
So I kind of went in that direction. I don't think all conceptualists would necessarily agree with that, but I think that does, like, this idea that yes, that there are these abstract categories that exist in a social or intersubjective realm that is to a great degree independent of individual minds, but not, as in the harder realist positions, independent of all minds. Does that make sense? So I think there
Does
is,
anybody else want to
yeah, sorry, go.
throw? Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I just want to know if I've invited, I think, almost everyone to speak if you wish to. It was not at all a pressure to do so, but if anyone wants to jump in and ask or elaborate, that'd be great. And if not, you can carry on.
Yeah, very happy to take questions. So yeah, feel free to jump in anytime if anyone has any questions. Otherwise, I will continue on. So yeah, I kind of alluded to this issue that in China there's a rather different stuff going on. I'm trying to think if that's a better place to go, or whether kind of skepticism, the strands of skepticism and Epicureanism might also be interesting.
I think that the distinction between thinking in these kind of reality versus non-reality, or abstract versus non, these kind of dichotomies versus other ways of thinking that have a, I don't even know what you call the other more Eastern or Chinese way of thinking about reality as non-dichotomous. I think that would be a really super interesting thing, at least to put a flagpole down.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea. So, yeah, I'm getting a lot of that from this scholar called A.C. Graham. He is a translator of Zhuangzi and Liese, I think he's done parts of the Tao Te Ching as well. So he's kind of a specialist in Chinese philosophy in the period, let's say, like 500 BC to maybe like 500 AD. So that's around, like, the Buddha is pretty much contemporary with many of the pre-Socratic philosophers, as well as with Confucius, as well as some of the people who are writing the Old Testament, as well as, by some estimations, Zoroaster. He used to be kind of dated earlier, but this is kind of an interesting thing, right? Which is that, why are all these guys, like, pretty much contemporaneous with each other? And so Graham is looking at this period, 500 BC to 500 AD in China. And the reason those dates are significant is that it takes about 1,000 years for Buddhism to get to China. Or I think there's like maybe inroads in like the 2nd century AD, but it doesn't become like a big thing until later. And so before that, they kind of have their own thing going on. And I don't like it would be really fascinating to know what kind of influence these different strands of thought had on each other. Because I suspect there is some, but it's like it's very hard to find out information about this. But just starting with Confucius, so there's this another scholar called Herbert Fingeret, and he's writing in the early 70s, and he kind of popularizes Confucius for a Western audience. And one of his observations is that there's a lot of dualisms that exist for Westerners that just don't seem to really apply in Confucius. So there's not really an inner and outer. He argues, he thinks that Confucius is not really into making choices, which is weird. Like a lot of people reacted very badly to that because Confucius is pretty obsessed with ethics. But most of the questions, like he encourages this kind of thinking that is very open-ended. So it's kind of saying that the sage or the person who is virtuous, and he is obsessed with virtue, but like again, I don't know that virtue is ever defined. You know, in the Greek tradition, there's kind of these four cardinal virtues. They're definitely in Plato and the Stoics. And I think maybe they're even older than that, and they definitely end up influencing Christianity and stuff, and they are courage and prudence, and I'm sure someone else knows what the other ones are, but this I'm not sure that it's ever like defined in like categorical terms in Confucius, and he thinks that the right way to live is to kind of it is a case of reflection, and in a sense, in the broadest sense, is a case of choice, because it's often things like what should I do in this case, or what is the virtuous thing to do in this case? But I think what Graham finds Fingeret getting at in Confucius is that he does not, or he's very resistant. I think it's fair to say he does not pose alternatives, which is a thing that you find Socrates constantly doing, which is to say, well, it's either A or B, and then kind of forcing the other speaker to say which one it is. And often in Socrates, in the Platonic dialogues, at least I'm reading the early ones, so I'm talking mainly about the Euthyphro, the Apology, and the Crito. I don't know if those are strictly speaking the earliest, but they are around the time of Socrates' death, and I think they're sort of thought to be more like the historical Socrates. And what he's constantly doing is this stepping back movement, where someone will say, you know, they'll be debating what it means to be pious or respect the gods. And they'll give an individual example, and Socrates will say, no, I don't want to know your experience. I want to know the abstract principle of piety. And so he's kind of disavowing individual cases. And I think it might be too much of a generalization to say that Confucius never does this, but he's more resistant to doing that kind of move where you basically say, let's step back. And he really doesn't do this thing of saying it's one thing or the other. Now, the other thinker that's like really important in this regard, because I think by the time of later Confucians, probably like Mencius and the legalists, there is this kind of weighing of different alternatives. But that comes later. And there are still holdouts, in particular Zhuangzi, who very explicitly discusses this kind of logic and says, you know, from one point of view, that's it, and that's not it. He like what's interesting in Chinese is that apparently the term the verb for exist is more like it doesn't have this ontological sense. It's like it has a sense that it's like conforming to a word. So there's not this sense of like true and false in the abstract. There's this sense of like. I know I'm gonna butcher the pronunciation, but it's like she is basically to say that something conforms to a name. So there's a sense that, you know, rather than saying ontologically, like the tree exists, it's like saying, yeah, that thing conforms to the thing that we both know as tree. So, in Chinese philosophy, there is like this resistance, and in Zhuangzi, it's very explicit. Like he writes like someone who really profoundly understands logic, and essentially says that it is like he is, I would say it's fair to say he's an anti-rationalist, but he is not opposed to reasoning in all cases. He just sees it as potentially limiting because it can cause you to create these abstractions and then you interact with those abstractions, whereas it's better for him to interact with life. And so reasoning has its uses, but it's only one tool of many for Zhuangzi. And I think this is important to emphasize because it's a very Western thing to say, well, if you don't believe in a correspondence theory of truth, which is this idea that language, that the job of philosophy and thinking and maybe theology is to get our concepts to most accurately map onto reality and to describe it really well, to be internally consistent, and that's the job of philosophy. I think that's it's fair to say the project from probably Socrates to Spinoza, certainly. So that's, a good 2000 years. By the time you get to someone like Nietzsche, it's quite different. And Heidegger as well would are kind of going are opposing trends to this. But what's interesting in Chinese philosophy is that it happens very early on that there's this resistance, and that this resistance is preserved in the Zhuangzi, and they're okay with having that exist. I'm not saying that there isn't resistance in Greece. So specifically, the Epicurean strand, which eventually it's not popular at the time. Epicurus is kind of an outsider, and he's in this vein of Democritus and Leucippus, who are these guys are hard determinists. They're also they are also atomists, so they basically believe that there are these indissoluble atoms, and they kind of think that it's weird because, of course, I just said that they're determinists, but they also think that things depend a lot on chance. So it's like there's chance interactions of atoms, and those determine everything that we see, something like that. And so the reason I think this is important to talk about is because although Epicurus leaves almost no writings, he leaves a couple of letters, and that's about it. And there's a later writer, a Roman writer, about 4 centuries later, called Lucretius, who writes On the Nature of Things. And this preserves this strand of resistance to. I'm actually not sure that I would say it's a resistance to the correspondence theory of truth, but it is this, I would say it's fair to say it's a skeptical strand, and it's very opposed to Platonism and to Christianity. And for that reason, they are kind of persecuted. Whether Epicurus maps on directly to Lucretius or not is a open question. It's one that's very difficult. If it may be possible to answer, because a lot of one problem is that all the Epicurean documents were housed in Herculaneum, which is very close to Vesuvius. And basically, when that volcano went up off, it just buried a ton of the Epicurean documents. Now, the weird thing is we actually have these, but everyone's been like too scared to like open them lest they fall to dust. So there actually is still like some chance that Epicurean documents will, through luck and modern kind of restoration techniques, yield more documents, which is kind of exciting. But the reason I want to emphasize their importance is because not only do they have this atomism, which in my view becomes quite important for Newton, the corpuscular view, and but they're also looking at this kind of idea that what we see is not only not it's not on, it's not just that we don't see what's truly there, they have a little bit of that element, although that's more associated with Puro and the hardline skeptics, which I can talk about more later. But what's important here is that it's like they're also anti-teleological. And in this sense, I think they influence not only Spinoza, but that both Lucretius and Spinoza influenced Darwin, because Darwin has this idea that what you see is not necessarily, the conditions, like in a certain sense, whatever you see is a statement about the environment. But in another sense, like you're not seeing the competition that goes on, and you're not going seeing the randomness, the random variation that produces the kind of fuel for selection. So to me, this is really interesting because these are guys that kind of were persecuted by the dominant philosophies for a very long time. There's also evidence that Democritus was at least it's pretty it's like he's said to have had contact with the guys called the Magi, and these are like Persian philosophers. He's also said, or it's rumored in Diogenes Laertius, that he goes to India. And Democritus is living, I think he dies in like, let's see, I think he dies in like 370 BC. So this is like, I think he's like 460 to 370. And he is the first one to have this atomist view. But in India, there are these atomist views going back to like 500, maybe even 800 BC. So that is fascinating to me because it might be that, this strand of philosophy that, although it's not popular, is really important, at least in terms of the Newtonian revolution and the Darwinian revolution, is essentially from this kind of minority and outside force that at various points Christianity and even the dominant Greek philosophers and I don't know the degree to which the Romans actually persecuted them, but definitely the Christians hate the Epicureans. And even at the time when Epicurus is alive, he's alive, let's say, about 300 BC. I'm not sure the exact date. Diogenes Laertius, who some he this is a Greek kind of historian of philosophy who's writing in about 100 AD. And he, some people think, because his whole last book is on Epicurus. There's 10 other books, or sorry, there's 9 other books. There's 10 books in total. And for some of them, like I think Democritus gets a handful of pages, Anaximander or Thales, who you might have heard of, they're kind of big deals for being some of the first philosophers. I think Anaximander gets like, like half a page or something, whereas Epicurus gets like a whole book. And so some people, this has led some people to think that Laertius himself is an Epicurean. But even at that time, it's basically, there's tons of slander about Epicurus because he puts pleasure as the indicator of whether you're doing things right. Like he doesn't believe, as the Stoics do, that there is some kind of abstract virtue to which you can, an abstract ideal that you can live towards, and then that's defining of the good life. And if it's a grim sort of struggle through life, that doesn't matter because all that matters is virtue. No, for Epicurus, it has to also be pleasurable. And so he was already getting a lot of flack for that in the 3rd century BC because everyone just thought that meant get drunk and sleep with everyone and everything like that, even though he's very explicit because he's constantly giving these examples and saying, like, yeah, we've all seen the people who do that. They don't seem to sustain that kind of pleasure for long. And so he ends up kind of in this virtue position by saying that what you're optimizing for is long-term pleasure, which requires certain kind of precautions, certain kinds of like it does require moderation. But he also thinks that, if that life is a grim slog and it's no fun for you or anyone else, then that, in his definition, can't be the good life. So there's all kinds of reasons that the Epicureans, like, people don't like the randomness, people don't like it is hedonist in the true sense of it's about pleasure. So that's my take on the Epicureans. Does anyone want to jump in? That might have been too much.
Yeah, anyone want to jump in on any parts of that last? Because you've thrown in quite a bit. I think that the going like going back to Xuanzang and so on, you say often that he's resisting, and then you describe different things that he might be resisting. It's not just dichotomies, right? It's is there not a resistance towards any kind of constraining of, okay, this is my dumb take on so far on what I'm thinking about the resistance to. It's a resistance to the kind of Socratic naming of what the options for truth might be. And by doing so, you don't allow for the option of anything outside of those dichotomies to exist or to be experienced or to be worked through. Is that somehow correct?
Yes.
And
And so,
what is the option?
actually,
Go ahead.
yeah, this is a really fascinating thing because Zhuangzi says this very explicitly, that as soon as you divide the world into categories, you've actually damaged the world. So it's necessary to have these categories kind of as for language and for the purpose of making sense with each other, but not to mistake them for some kind of ultimate reality. And he's very clear that, you for him, the important thing is what's called illumination. And basically, that's like a it is dialectical, but it's not dialectical in the Socratic sense where, Socrates is kind of involved in this exercise of, okay, we start from an assumption that there must be something consistent called the good, and we're going to keep asking questions in this conversation until we find out what that is. For Zhuangzi, I would say it's more like a pragmatist view, which is that, those categories don't necessarily correspond to anything, but you have to use them. You have to kind of pick them up and use them as tools. And so for him, illumination is that process, which is like we kind of and like it's intersubjective and it's dialectical, but it's not competitive. And I think it's also important to remember that although Socrates is constantly insisting that he knows nothing, he is using these techniques not just of rhetoric, but of this thing called heuristics, which is basically a form of rhetoric which is designed to make your opponent look stupid, basically. And one of the principal not principle, there are probably many ways to do this, but one of the interesting ones that he deploys frequently is by creating a kind of false dichotomy, and then forcing the opponent to choose. Like you can create dichotomies where they're both wrong in different ways, and as long as you're prepared to take down the argument on either side, you can say, well, do you think it's A or B? And then you're in the position of kind of power because you can take this line of questioning to basically show how that position is inconsistent. And this relates again. So Zhuangzi, yeah, for people who don't know, he comes to be seen as the major thinker besides Laozi, who writes the Tao Te Ching. And the Tao Te Ching is some parts of it are probably super ancient. I think it's we even have like a really early copy of it, but I can't remember the exact dates. I think it's like 400 or 500 BC. Whereas Zhuangzi is living, I think like around again around 300 BC. I think he dies in the 200s. And he shows evidence of having been through what's called Mohism, which is a pretty make same. I don't want to say it's advanced because it makes it sound kind of defensive. It's a utilitarian ethics. It's highly rational, and it's one branch of many of Chinese philosophy in that time. So the idea that, reason is this uniquely, Greek philosophical thing is not true, but it's also not true that rationality plays such a central role as it does in Greece. In China, they know about it and they're like, yeah, that's useful for certain kinds of calculations, but that is not the be all and end all, and it need not necessarily touch reality. In part because they're words for, as I said, for true and false and for being don't carry this ontological baggage as most of the Indo-European languages do, I think.
I think if I may,
Yes.
if it is to be taken as a fact that they are aware of this but don't use it, that would seem to me to refute itself, because if they were aware of the power of this of the Greek method, if you will, they would have used it. So I don't think, and this goes back to which is the reason I wanted to speak anyway. Like your colleague Isabel, before I kind of got my ear stuck on when you said resisted, because I think you have to be aware of the thing you are resisting in order to be able to resist it. And I wonder if it was just your choice of words, or if you really think that these people saw these things in front of them and were consciously resisting them, which is to say, to make a choice not to use this sort of thinking and instead use another one. Because it seems to me that there wasn't much resisting going on, but more like a state of not being aware. That make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. So it's a great question. And my understanding is that there's this strand called Moism between the 4th century and 3rd century BC in China. And it does do quite advanced what we would call logic. And most of it is in the vein of the kind like Aristotelian logic. And
But logic, just a quick clarification.
yes.
Logic in order, just as a sort of intellectual armchair sort of abstract way, just to play with the thought, or logic in order to achieve something? Because what seems, for me at least, to be always underestimated is how much the Greeks in particular were pretty, what's the right word? They did their armchair thing, of course,
Yes.
but it seems to me that they did enjoy doing it for just doing it, but it had, for them to have a quality, it had to have a certain amount of applicability to the real world. So it was not just for argument's sake, the arguing,
Yes.
even if it sounds like that.
Yes.
And
Yeah.
it seems to me, if you go back to ancient times, generally, I think we tend in our time that we live in, we tend to underestimate the energy that was used by these people to even if they enjoyed their armchair talk, at the end they wanted to attain something new. So, if you will, move atoms in the world at some point.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, what's going on in Greece is a kind of amazing explosion of like theory and practice at the same time. And it's a really interesting question, like the degree to which they inform each other. I mean, I think you're right. They must. There have been arguments from people, like the one that comes to mind is from Carl Sagan in Cosmos, that the Athenians kind of represent this more this tendency towards abstraction and towards theorizing and towards some kind of like more emphasis. Maybe, you know, it's not that they're purely in this world of theory, because of course they are doing many things in the world as well, and fighting lots of wars at the same time. But that the Ionians, and to some degree maybe the Eleatics or the Milesians, I think. Yeah, so the Ionians and the Milesians are much more interested in kind of the observation and science kind of aspect. Now, these guys are all in contact, and many of the ones that are important, of whether that's the Eleatics or the Milesians or other people, many of them end up in Athens anyway. And so these things must be influencing each other. And I don't think that they It would be a particularly ironic thing for me to say that, oh, there's a hard line between, this theory and practice, because I'm kind of, to some degree, saying trying to soften those lines, not to argue that they should never exist or that it's never useful to make those distinctions, but that sometimes seeing things in sort of spectrums can be useful. And for Zhuangzi, I think he is pretty well acquainted with what we would. I don't want to say that exactly that it's Aristotelian logic, because I don't know enough about Mohism to discuss that. But they are familiar with it, and the Mohists are pragmatists. Or well, pragmatist is probably a little too loaded. I should be more specific. They're practical thinkers, and they're utilitarian ethics, and they come not from sort of a scholarly class, but from farmers. And so they, like the implication is that they do utilitarian reasoning, and it's a pretty advanced system of logic. But and Zhuangzi is aware of it, but he thinks that it can be taken too far. Does that make sense?
I think to some extent I was trying to think of a more concrete example for what I meant. For example, if you take someone like David Deutsch, with his Beginning of Infinity, if you were to bury this book and rediscover 2,000 years later, like we rediscovered via some roots, the ancient Greeks again, you could be led to believe, I think, to a large extent, if not to 100%, that he as well was just an armchair philosopher who of course took examples from the physical world, but who mainly just did this. And that is the that seems to me a bit of a problem in trying to reassemble what these people lived like and why they did what they did. For example, I just saw something about the Antikythera mechanism. You know, this watchmaker quality mechanism from 2,300 years ago. And it's interesting because the people who especially the Greeks, who are not philosophers maybe in their genes, but who somehow in their intuition by being fed all this historical knowledge in school, who had this intuition of knowing it, these people knew more than we can now imagine they knew. And then this mechanism was found and discovered what it really was. It gave them more ammunition for arguments to say, hey, you see, we told you these people, it wasn't just armchair stuff. And I wonder, like I said, I wonder if you take a couple of these popular science books today, bury them and rediscover them.
Would they
If
appear?
you weren't led to a wrong path of believing that these people were just dealing in abstractions, where it should at least to some extent be obvious that they didn't just do this out of the fun for doing it.
I think that's super important, and especially because many of these strands that I'm quite interested in, whether it's the Epicureans or the Pyrrhonists, the skeptics, they leave very few writings. And the writings that we have are very hard to interpret because they're no longer a living tradition. That actually, one thing that's kind of interesting about the Chinese and Indian traditions is that many of them still are alive, even though some of them are quite moribund. But this is, I think, what you're saying is exactly right, is that there's only so much you can get from texts, and they may lead you to a more abstract understanding than is fair. Maybe I could talk a little bit about.
Or sorry, I could, I could, I could, I could, I could, I could switch it around and apply this line of thinking to us in this round right here.
Yes.
Because why are we even discussing these things? Are we discussing these things just to understand how these people came to the conclusions they came to, or are we doing this to create new knowledge, which in turn is going to help us change the world in a more proactive way?
Yeah, it's a great question.
I mean, for example, or even more concretely, why are you doing this right now?
So, I'm kind of fascinated by these topics and by the way that knowledge kind of consolidates, and also like how schools of thought like either survive or die. And I do think it has consequences for how we think today. But I'm not actually sure that I have I guess I'm still thinking through a lot of this stuff, and so I'm not sure if I have like a you know an easy prescription about like how this can be practically used. But I kind of tend towards you can probably tell like a slightly pragmatist understanding of truth, and that I kind of think that if it never applies to life, then it is just kind of, yeah, like you say, armchair theorizing or something like that.
And if I can just jump in, because I've had a few of these discussions with you, Brian, I think it also has, I know I'm jumping bajillions of steps ahead, but it has huge implications on how we think of scientism, how we privilege science over, it's certainly over things like philosophy, but also just this, and how we just assume and we go about our day assuming that what we are doing in domains of science and so on are something much more true and pragmatic and leading towards something that will be ultimately, and by the way, I'm a scientist, so it's not that I'm not wholly for the work of scientists, but that there is this now tendency towards not questioning the concepts and the theories and the three theoretical foundations from which we've kind of come to understand many of the ideas that we now work on. And I think going back to the roots of whether we think of something categorically as one thing or another, because we have a system of thinking that forces us into that dichotomous categorization thinking is really important for how we even ask the questions we're asking about reality and therefore what we do about it.
Yeah, completely. And yeah, sorry, go on.
Sorry. I wonder if it even matters so much, because it seems to me that in this, wherever we want this or not, but we do live in a physical world, so at some point, a real life problem is going to approach, and then we are going to have to solve it. And at the very least, or at the very latest, in that moment, you're going to have to be able to find concrete solutions for concrete problems. And that is the moment at which you're going to put to the test how much of your armchair theorizing will remain. Like my parents taught me, culture is what's left when the money has run out. I can't put it more concretely than this. I need to think a little bit.
No,
Yeah, maybe that makes sense, maybe it doesn't.
that's great. Yeah, and like to be clear, I am very. I kind of think that what's important about all this philosophizing is it needs to be redirected at nature, basically. And so I am actually a little bit wary of totalizing theoretical systems, because we started with Spinoza's ethics, which I just, like I kind of get hung up on the axioms. I'm like, wait, why am I accepting these? You know what I mean? And but I also think that, like, I guess where I'm coming from, the investigation of nature is super important. And the degree to which we can kind of form a consensus that that is the direction that we want to go without requiring that consensus to like eliminate all dissent about what might be going on or different ways of conceptualizing. So it's kind of, I guess my interests are one direct intellectual attention towards both practical matters and matters of nature, like the investigation of nature, and two, do that without extinguishing kind of holdouts to the dominant paradigm, let's say. So I, you know, the it's not like I'm in any position to make any decisions that impact that at all. But that's why I'm thinking through how did knowledge progress over the last, few thousand years? Because I'm interested in it progressing over the future, and I'm not interested in it progressing in the sense of just sheer accumulation, nor of, kind of abstract philosophizing, but it has to make contact with practical concerns and with whatever things we do find through experiment. So the trial and error aspect is like really important to me. But that I totally realize that may not come through at all when I'm just talking about a lot of dead philosophers who, haven't had a living practicing, we don't know what their lives were like in many cases.
Just to be a bit of a contrarian here, I just remembered some. I don't know who of you knows Paul Graham.
Yes.
Yes. Did you ever see on his website with his essays? He has a rarely asked questions section.
No, I haven't seen that.
And one of the questions is, what philosophy books would you recommend?
Yeah.
And he says, I can't think of any I'd recommend. What I learned from trying to study philosophy is that the place to look is in other fields. If you understand math or history or aeronautical engineering very well, the most abstract of the things you know are what philosophy is supposed to be teaching. Books on philosophy per se are either highly technical stuff that doesn't matter much or vague concatenations of abstractions their own authors didn't fully understand. Example given, Hegel.
Yes.
It can be very interesting to study ancient philosophy, but more as a kind of accident report than to teach you anything useful. Now, of course, he's very pragmatic, so it might sound extremely naive to somebody who studied much philosophy. But I also find it at the same time very refreshing because that this energy with which he writes this seems to me to be the same thing. Like if you take Bach or Beethoven and put them in today's time, they are not going to compose music for symphony orchestras. They are going to make electronic music because these people were always at the cutting edge.
Yes.
So while I share the interest in ancient philosophy and ancient thinking, I think what in general, we should do is to try to take these methods of thinking and pull ourselves out from this or remove these shackles, let's say, of this heavy and long history of dead thinkers and try to get to new stuff.
Yes.
But that's just a random
No, I'm
interruption.
actually largely sympathetic to that. Yeah, I don't agree with Graham that philosophy shouldn't be read, although I might agree that Hegel shouldn't be read. I have not had too much interaction with him, but many people, including Tolstoy, Schopenhauer, Charles Sanders Peirce, I have a lot. There's a long list of people who just find basically nothing useful in Hegel. Of course, there are people who are more arguably pragmatic, like Karl Marx, who were very influenced by Hegel. Feuerbach as well, who leads arguably on to Freud and to some other people. What I'm arguing is actually that philosophy kind of acts as a repository of ideas that may not all be right. This is also Thomas Kuhn's view, and this would be compatible with the kind of thing that I'm arguing that, that Newton couldn't have happened when he did had Democritus and Epicurus, at least the tatters of them, not been preserved. And the same goes for Darwin, probably could not have done what he did without the preservation of Lucretius. So I actually don't think that most people, science probably at most times, Thomas Kuhn says this explicitly. He says it should and does keep philosophy at arm's length. But in times of crisis, it can become critical. And actually, you can kind of see this in certain parts of cognitive science. And Isabella, you might be able to talk more about whether this is true in other fields. That you're seeing, actually, they're going back to Kant, they're going back to these earlier thinkers, because certain things, like, let's say, the computationalist view of the mind, are just running out of steam. Progress is not being made in that way. I know there's other people in this room who are probably working on the cutting edge and saying, yeah, nobody's been doing computationalist stuff for 40 years or whatever. But the point is that, just because it's not immediately practical, it doesn't mean that it's not a kind of important repository for problem solving, let's say. And that can be even.
That is true. That is true.
Can I say that there is somebody with their hand up if they would like to speak? I don't know. I only see Athene. I don't know if you want to
Sure.
jump in. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much. One of the things that I would just simply say, my particular field of specialty is within classical philosophy and postmodern philosophy.
Oh, amazing.
And one of the things that I hear very often is, particularly among those who are inclined towards science, and that's not something that I say lightly, because I myself originally started in a mathematics PhD program before moving to the philosophy department for the PhD. Is that it's very dangerous for people to start thinking of classical philosophy or older philosophies as kind of long dead people who are essentially sort of I guess studied for a kind of antiquarian curiosity, because both Nietzsche and Heidegger returned to the pre-Socratics for very, very important reasons. And Heidegger himself did, in fact, sit on numerous PhDs in mathematics, and I think one or two in physics as well. So these people were fully on board with knowing quite a bit about many, many contemporary issues that we really fool ourselves in thinking that we've gotten past. And they, in fact, were aware of these things, and that's precisely why they turned back to a lot of these earlier thinkers. And certainly, I'm not thinking about someone like Kant or anything. I mean, I'm thinking about going all the way back, to sort of the pre-Socratics, and of course, Nietzsche's pushing back even to Homer and things like that. The main reason is precisely because it's very possible, and I would argue it's in fact the case, that they were never really fully understood in the first place. I mean, that's sort of the whole point of sedimentation, which we get from Husserl and then again with Heidegger, is that these things set in, these poor readings have sort of set in, and then the natural desire of sort of the human aspect of things is to believe so much in progress. That we think that we're smarter than these people in some respects, so that we don't necessarily have something not just to learn from them, but something quite fundamental. And one thing I would add, especially with regard to just the title of this space, abstraction.
Yes.
In the Greek, the word is aphaereses. Now, with both Plato and Aristotle, they only ever use that term very specifically with regard to numbers, and that's quite instructive. And one of the most powerful critiques of someone like, for instance, Thomas Kuhn, who is to be taken very seriously. I mean, I know you had just mentioned him, is provided by a gentleman, Jacob Klein, one of Husserl's better students, and a student of Heidegger also. And he points out in his critique of Kuhn is that the one thing that Kuhn misses that's rather fundamental is that he never really considers the possibility that there was already a revolution that had taken place in mathematics itself. And that's going to be sort of what we begin to see with Husserl with regard to the crisis of the European sciences, where he's talking about what happens when we move from to the sort of the pre-modern or the modern era with Galileo and the mathematization of yes. things, and this is going to be problematic. And again, because this is going to come back to the word aphoresis, because when we abstract away from certain things, it's quite possible that if we're doing more than just using that word abstraction with regard to number, then we're losing something very, very important. And of course that gets extremely complicated very quickly with regard to what are called eidetic numbers and such. But that, all of this is just simply to say that it is very, very dangerous to simply presume that you know these older thinkers are somehow just antiquarian kind of things to learn from, perhaps. But not necessarily to learn from in a fundamental way. And I would just simply suggest that there is some kind of deep fundamental knowledge that we still have to learn from them, that we have our kind of our own blinders on, precisely because of this sort of sedimentation of the sort of the typical textbook readings of philosophy and stuff. And that's to say, I understand that, though, because, for instance, I can't be Or I never would have been able to be sort of the expert in mathematics without having to turn away from it and bury myself for many, many years in the philosophy. And so I can certainly understand why those errors could occur with a lot of these exceptionally talented scientists who are able to do a good bit of work in philosophy, but unfortunately, they end up missing some of the more fundamental issues, which we're going to see, again, things that are going to pop up with, like, Husserl such, and these kinds of reconstructions of the history of philosophy that might have gone astray and can provide us a teaching of the human things that's going to have great, great impact on the natural things, which is to say the physiologoi themselves, because for instance, prudence, the virtue of prudence being one that yes. we see very, very, very problematic in Heidegger. But anyway, I just wanted to add that. Thank you so much for the mic. This is a very, very wonderful space. It's a pleasure to be here with you all.
No, thank you so much. I actually couldn't agree more. I'm really fascinated by the kind of divergent thinking in especially in the pre-Socratics, and Nietzsche has a very pretty unorthodox take, I guess, from pretty much anyone else. I mean, I guess to some degree, Heidegger takes this line. I would love to hear more about about that aspect. But I guess, you know, from their point of view, everything important is done in Greek philosophy by the time that Socrates arrives, basically, and that's a very different understanding from pretty much everyone else, right?
Just to quickly, I of course I don't want to be misunderstood as having said that one should not, at the very least, be aware of the ancient philosophers, but in my view, it. And it might be sacrilege to say that in this round, but in my view, it's enough to read a sort of meta-analysis of what they said. You don't have to read the whole text, although I do like Socrates claiming he doesn't know anything and then using that knowledge to go from door to door and tell everybody else how stupid they are. So it is amusing. It is very amusing. But if you take somebody like Elon Musk, if he makes it to Mars in 10, 15 years, that is a physical achievement, which of course will stand on the shoulders of the people that came before him in the physical sciences. But in the end, it is just human bodies on another planetary body in our solar system. But that will have so many implications in philosophy and that's what I meant early on when I said that when a concrete problem is coming, you at some point you have to act physically to challenge it. One of my interests in ancient philosophy is trying to find out, especially in the case of Greece, how they could have gotten so close. You mentioned Carl Sagan before, Brian. Mm. I think it was also Carl Sagan who said that if they had been able to continue on their trajectory that which they had for another 300 years, they would have made it to the moon. And so keeping that in mind, for me, it's interesting to find out why did they fail, you know? And that is, there's a couple of things, but that is, for me at least, it's the main thing to try to find out. I mean, the Greeks stand out in this, but there's other places you could look where similar things have happened. Not to the extent, but where you could also see a germ of something that then got extinguished. And so there's lessons to be learned, of course. So that is where I make the ancient philosophy concrete for myself, to see how could that be a lesson to not make that mistake again.
Brian, I wonder if you wanted, again, don't pick this up if you don't want to go down this stream, but I wonder if you wanted to address this idea of whether indeed it is useful to use a meta-analysis of philosophers of the past, or in fact, that's actually quite the opposite of what we should be doing. And the original writers and reading the originals might be much more important in terms of, you know, progressing concretely forward, whatever that might feel to you. You don't have to take that on, but I think Kuhn certainly has a lot to say about the difference between maybe philosophy and science when it comes to just reading the textbook summaries.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kuhn has, he thinks that textbooks both have a great feature, which is that they get everyone up to the cutting edge incredibly fast, but they also lead to this kind of groupthink, in the sense that, and they also they rewrite history to make it look sort of continuous. So it's great as long as that science is currently functioning. And he sees functioning as essentially progressing in the same way that something like physics or chemistry was progressing over the period, pretty much the 100 years before him, you know, sort of like mid 19th century to the 50s. And he publishes his Structure of Scientific Revolutions in 62. He says that science is, when they ask, is X a science, what they really mean is, why is X not progressing like physics, basically? And so it is an important question. I, like, you can see in Kuhn's take something that I would say too, which is that, first of all, you can never read everything. And so, you know, there is a great case to be made for reading meta-analyses and overviews, and then from there, diving deeper potentially in the areas that interest you. But for me, kind of engaging with primary materials to the extent that I can, and in some cases, especially with the pre-Socratics, there's so little left of some of them that you are dependent very much on second, third hand sources. So you know, it's not always the case that you have a choice between the original, you know, pristine text and someone else's interpretation. It may be all kind of hearsay and interpretation in some cases. But yeah, I actually, you can tell that I'm hesitant because on the one hand, I think that it is, for me, it's super important to go back to primary sources, but I don't think that that's necessary in every case. Like, you know, well, first of all, it's just impossible to do to some degree. yeah, I guess my view is that start with the meta-analysis and then go deeper, you know, like ask the kind of questions of the source, because those questions are not dead. And these original writers, you know, it was just was looking at this thing, the Brewer-Hilbert controversy, which I'm sure someone in the audience can explain to me much better than I understand it. But it seems to have something to do with this issue of the law of the excluded middle, which comes out of Aristotelian logic. It's certainly contained in it. And this is a thing that, like, many of the pre-Socratics just, like, negated, you know? And so the fact that this is like a, okay, it's not exactly recent, but it's in the last century, let's say. And I don't know that it was really satisfactorily resolved in the 20th century. So I'm sorry, I have my screen off, so I didn't actually catch the person who was speaking about the pre-Socratics and Nietzsche and Heidegger. Who is that actually? Are you still here?
I was referencing that. I should, however, emphasize that my own take on that is that, and this is sort of following Husserl and Klein in this respect, yes. Is that it's better to there's very much more to still learn from Plato and Aristotle that's been misunderstood. That's where Husserl is really sort of picking up the ball. And going with his eidetic reductions and such, that was sort of one of the things. And you're exactly right. The problem with the pre-Socratics, and I've often joked and said that one of the reasons Heidegger returns so much to the pre-Socratics and is that it's so easy to do violence to their fragments. but again, I say that rather jokingly, though, because Heidegger was a first-rate philosopher, and so there's very, very much that he does find there, but. But anyway, yeah, sorry. Go ahead, please.
Go ahead.
Yeah, please go ahead.
I was just going to say that Christopher also has his hand up for quite a while. So maybe
we can
hear from him a little.
Well, first and foremost, I want to thank you both for this space. I actually found this space because my friend Athenian and I tend to join spaces where I see Athenian because I love hearing him talk about philosophy. But I wanted to bring it back to the 18th and 19th century, which is where I work, and I work in German idealism and romanticism. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something very important about the thinkers like Schelling and Hegel. Now, mm-hmm. I'm a Schellingian, so I'll bring up Schelling as my example. These thinkers were taking the history of science, philosophy, aesthetics, and ethics, and bringing them together, making philosophical encyclopedias that were and working with the science of the time to philosophize and think about not only just the human being, but nature, reality, the cosmos, I think. When I think about a thinker like Schelling, the importance of going back to his work is because he is really reacting to the dualism and the kind of mechanical thinking of the early modern era. So Descartes, this kind of damage that they've done to the, you know, their understanding of the cosmos being monistic, mechanical, and Schelling trying to make this organic and to talk about how human beings and the world were enmeshed, were intertwined. And so I like this. I like the idea of even going back to the pre-Socratics, or going back to these texts because they're very important. So we can take someone, we can take a text like Schelling or even Hegel, and we can look at it and read it, and really concentrate the ideas. But I think we can also apply these ideas to what's going on right now. The philosopher Graham Harman once stated in a live lecture that he has a lot of physicist friends, and they always keep saying, hey, you know, between the battles of Einsteinian physics and string theory and quantum theory, we don't really have a a universal theory of everything right now. We really are looking to the philosophers to throw out some concepts for us to, you know, to help balance everything, because it seems like science has kind of subsumed everything below it. But we can take a kind of organic and bringing back the Wissenschaft, bringing back the Geisteswissenschaft, this idea that the humanities isn't just philosophy and art, it's also the sciences and mathematics and everything. And just kind of, that's all I was trying to say.
Yeah, thank you. That's fascinating. Yeah, and I should say the disclaimer that I have not read Hegel, but I have read Schopenhauer, and so that probably is like slightly affecting my negative view. And that is basically ignorant of me. I will at some point get into Hegel, and I would love to hear more about Schelling. I actually know very little about him.
And did you want to talk a little bit about Schopenhauer on logic, since we're here now? Brian?
Yeah, I might just like mention he has this strand also about perfection. At the very start, we were talking about Spinoza's notion that perfection in concrete terms just means finished, and then it eventually becomes kind of more abstract to this ideal that people, you know, get on the basis of experience, but then they forget that, and then they assume that there is this thing called perfection, and then they project that out into this idea that nature should conform or should be producing something like an abstract perfection, which requires a bunch of different abstractions. Schopenhauer observes a similar trajectory with logic, and I'm sure since mm-hmm. there are sort of experts on Heidegger and stuff in here, that they may have more to say about this. But for Schopenhauer, logic, you know, it has this kind of spoken quality. It means word, but it can also mean, I think, like argument or debate or something like that, or maybe like explanation. And it seems to change meanings over time. And for him, he thinks that they get sort of cemented in Aristotle after tons of experimentation, both through the sophists and basically other forms of debate, where people make inferences. So in the same way that, let's say, you and I are having a discussion, we would agree on what we agree on and kind of say, okay, these are our premises, this is where we agree, and then we start the debate. That people were doing that increasingly by observing how, like, which forms of arguments work. And through that process, essentially an inferential one producing the rules that become Aristotelian logic. And mm-hmm. then those are kind of baked into the start of every, you know, discussion, but they come first from speech, right? And Schopenhauer is not the only one who believes this. Actually, Charles Sanders Peirce also believes that the rules of logic must be empirical, in the sense that if you were to just have a bunch of experiences that contradicted the rules of logic, you would have to change the rules of logic. You couldn't, you know, and so in other words, they come from experience. And my understanding is that Quine also takes up this view, which is that logic isn't something that exists in sort of in this abstract realm. I could be wrong. I know there's some people in this room that probably know logic and the history of logic much better than I am. But that was something that really fascinated me, because it seemed to me that the form of Schopenhauer's argument is very similar to Spinoza's, which is to observe that these things start out in concrete, contextual, indexical places where people are trying things out, like a trial and error kind of place. And from there, they get abstracted until we treat them like they are, you know, entities that exist in their own rights. So mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone wants to think
about Zineb.
Well, you are right, because Arthur Schopenhauer was heavily influenced by Spinoza. So they had a very similar type of logical inferences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has some issues with Spinoza because he believes, well, Schopenhauer, he's really upset about anti-teleological views, even though arguably that's kind of Darwin's position. And but very helpfully, Schopenhauer enumerates them and tries to like argue against them. And one is Francis Bacon. Another is Spinoza. And the final one is Lucretius. So these are the ideas that nature itself has no fixed goal. Like it does progress from a starting point, but it doesn't progress towards some endpoint. And that's massively influential for Darwin. It is also influential for Thomas Kuhn, who is doing this in a kind of cultural evolution space and saying we can make observations about how and when, you know, revolutions in thought happen, but we can't actually say that they're getting closer to anything.
Thanks, Brian. Zineb, I think your hand was up, and then Athenian again.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So, yeah, I just wanted to add up on what Brian was saying, because what is important for Schopenhauer isn't what is wrong and what is right, because you can follow a certain logic, and within that logic, you are absolutely right. So the problem, you know, this is something he touched on the art of being right, because what is important for Schopenhauer isn't being wrong or being right. You can be wrong and right using depending on the logic you're following. And Schopenhauer was very, can I say this? Yeah, he just didn't like the sophists who used like tricks to show that they are right, because all their, you know, he displayed a lot of like stratagems, you know, 38 stratagems to sound right or to be right. But the concern for Schopenhauer was really the truth. He was looking at what is true beyond beyond speech, because for him this is what this is where reasoning is good and is valuable, because it's what is true beyond the tricks and the stratagems of looking right, that actually exposes the real will of people and of the human being. So yeah, I just wanted to add on that.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, that's really helpful. I am aware of that essay about being right, but I haven't read it. Sorry, go on.
I think Athenian was gonna
go. Oh yeah.
Yeah, go for it, please.
Yeah, no, one thing I wanted to add, I always love whenever people bring up Peirce, because I just enjoy the fact, because in many respects, I think I can relate to this aspect of him, which is something I do not recommend for anyone, is that Peirce was notorious. I mean, he by all accounts, he was a genius. I mean, the man was literally a genius. And he would go through these fits of unbelievable productivity for like, you know, a few weeks at a time, and accomplish more in a few weeks than most people could do in their lifetime. And then he would just sort of slump into a depression for about a year or so. And, you know, everyone would just sort of leave him alone. And then he would surface up to, you know, publish something else that's brilliant. But one thing I did want to add about this topic of logic, because this is so, so very, very important, and it's often overlooked. And I'm sure that my friend Chris could probably add a lot more to this than I could, because I'm just sort of going to give it a broad overview, is that what we start to see happening, particularly with Kant, and this is, of course, going to have great consequence for Schopenhauer, is that what was traditionally understood as logic in the form of, for instance, Aristotle's so-called Organon, right? But particularly the logic, is that it was never understood as something that was to of itself expand knowledge, right? It was simply to siphon out, to clarify up this thing we know as science, right? Episteme, or knowledge. Now with Kant, that's going to change. Logic is actually going to take on a much broader role than it had ever known before, because logic itself is going to be that which can expand science or human knowledge itself. I mean, he's even going to christen it with a new name, this kind of transcendental logic, transcendental philosophy, phenomenology. And then once you see that happen, it sort of unleashes a kind of Pandora's box. And so if you just sort of look at the various authors after Kant, always keep an eye out to the titles of some of their most famous works. So, for instance, Kant has all of his famous, well, I mean, in many respects, The Critique of Reason is a book on logic in many respects. But actually, I mean, it's so much more. But then once you get to Hegel, again, the masterpiece that he considers is his book he entitles The Logic. And then it's going to keep going like that, right? Husserl, his most famous works are going to be titled The Logical Investigations. When Heidegger writes Being and Time, he says that the only prerequisite he assumes more than anything else of the reader is going to be Husserl's Logical Investigations. And what I would suggest...
Wittgenstein, is, right?
yeah, right. yeah. But again, I want to emphasize, these are not books about logic that we would think of them as logic is somehow something that is set. These are very, very philosophical explorations of what logic actually should mean. And of course, that's going to have, for the purposes of this space, enormous consequences for the very understanding of science itself, because in many respects, one could say that logic is, or at least it has become since Kant, the method by which science is to progress, you know, whether that's going to be methodological or something else. But that's just something I like to throw out there, because it's one of those topics in philosophy that gets so extremely complicated that a lot of people aren't even aware of precisely what has that revolution and the understanding of logic that's taken place and still continues to take place, by the way. I mean, and as you rightly point out, with someone like Wittgenstein, or then we get into the later French deconstructionists, and sort of it's like all bets are off. But that's just very, very, I think, important for people to keep in mind, is that the very fundamental concept of logic itself is changing and changing radically. Beginning with at least beginning with Kant, going through all these various thinkers, and I would like to just simply finish by saying your comments about Hegel are not wasted on me at all. I appreciate the barbs. Unfortunately, I have had to read Hegel, and I still came out of it. I still came out of it thinking exactly what you're thinking going into it. So, but in any case, that's all I have to say.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and I'm really fascinated by this history of logic. You know, it's like one of those things that you think, well, you know, does it have a history? But, you know, like that's the kind of naive view of looking at it. But of course, you know, I guess maybe that's sort of Derrida's fundamental insight, is that all of these things that we treat as, you know, the most baseline assumptions by which we live sort of every moment of our life, we, you know, Althusser also says this about the logos, in which he misquotes the passage from, is it Acts of the Apostles, I think, where about in which we live and breathe and have our being. All of those things are, you know, constructed. That's Derrida's whole point. And I think anything that is conceptual had to have had a birthplace, at least in the minimal sense that, you know, presumably there was a point at which we didn't have language and didn't have concepts of any kind. And so they must have a provenance and a history. And to me, that's like, I don't know, just a something that I'm kind of fascinated by right now.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to... bring up something that Athenian had mentioned, this idea of Kant's transcendental logic, because it's so important. Because what he does, he realizes that the simple syllogism, you know, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. All that's happening in this is that we're simply just moving around predicates, or with modus ponens or modus tollens, we're either affirming the consequent or we're speaking in this sense. So what Kant is worried about is that we need a logic that we need a synthetic logic that can bring these predicates to real existence. So he's concerned about being and thinking and willing. So the transcendental logic, which becomes synthetic a priori, is how we understand mm-hmm. the world, how the world conforms to our understanding. This also is a problem too. It, you know, this idea that, you know, the world is only conforms to, you know, how our minds organize what we see in appearances. But this idea of, you know, moving away from the kind of strict syllogism and the strict logic and talking about how these predicates mean more than just words, they have to do with concrete reality. That's it.
No, that's super useful. Thank you so much. My Kant is not great, but it's super important that, yeah. Sorry, what's that? Sylvia, I've seen you're unmuted. Would you like to jump in?
I'm having a fun time here, just listening to all the very interesting things, what people have to say about logic and the true meaning behind it, and how it all started with Aristotle and the Pre-Socratics, and leading on to even Husserl and Spinoza and Schopenhauer. And it's very interesting to see how it's all related or interrelated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very long conversation that spans millennia, basically, isn't it?
I just required a copy of Husserl, Logical Investigations, and I'm actually very, very excited to be reading it.
Yeah, thank you all. I'm wondering if anyone else who hasn't put up their hand, or I've tried to grab everybody who comes in and give you an opportunity to be a speaker. I know that's not always everybody's choice, but please, if you'd like, just put up your hand, and if I've missed anyone, I can make sure to grab you up to the podium. Mm-hmm. Brian, I'm wondering if you wanted to take any last few directions.
I was thinking maybe, yeah, just like winding down if anyone has. Well, first of all, like this has been amazing. I've been wanting to do a kind of space just on, the history of logic, the kind of steps in abstraction that are required to get some of these things off the ground. And I also just got over COVID. And so during that whole COVID time, I was just reading philosophy. And I was like, I really want to talk to someone about all the stuff I've been reading. So I just wanted to thank everyone for coming and speaking and tolerating my very amateur, incursions into philosophy. Would anyone like to kind of make any closing comments or anything? I'd love to hear from anyone.
Well, Brian, I thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to be able to speak and listen in, especially if there's a lot of people who have a lot of great things to say. And I noticed you mentioned some of my favorites, like Husserl, Spinoza, Kant, Nietzsche, and Schopenhauer. Couldn't ask for more.
Thank you. Yeah, Jesse, I see you've just gotten on stage. Would you like to add anything?
Sure. I'm pretty happy. Don't worry, I won't spend 30 minutes talking about Peirce. But
but please.
No.
Well, yeah, we would actually welcome that.
I guess what I wanted to say is put in my two cents about reading primary sources versus summaries, especially of things like, it's sort of one thing if you're reading a technical manual, let's say, or even like a history of math papers, but you, like the example that popped into my head, like this comes up a lot with Peirce and often a lot of the other pragmatists, you know, Frank Ramsey, who read a lot of Peirce and was a close friend of Wittgenstein, died very young, did a lot of great work in economics and mathematics, but he was sort of the first person to outline what today would be called subjective Bayesianism, essentially the idea that subject to certain constraints, an ideal reasoner follows Bayes' rule. And it's easy to sort of distill, let's say, his paper down to that sentence, maybe elaborate on it with some math formulas. But a summary misses a lot, I think, of, let's say, like what the person was really trying to say, or at least it risks it. So I'm going to read a passage from the paper where he sort of first proves this theorem.
Yeah, please do.
He says, each of our definitions has been accompanied, and like this is a formal mathematical paper, okay. So each of our definitions has been accompanied by an axiom of consistency. And insofar as this is false, the notion of the corresponding degree of belief becomes invalid. This bears some analogy to the situation in regard to simultaneity discussed above, which I won't go into. I have not worked out the mathematical logic of this in detail, because this would, I think, be rather like working out to seven places of decibels, a result only valid to two. My logic can't be regarded as giving more than the sort of way it might work. And, you know, you see communities like, let's say, the rationalist community, where you sort of wonder, like, have they read this paper? Have they read Frank Ramsey's opinion on the idea of let's actually use like Bayes' theorem as an instrument to mold our own thinking? Whereas Frank Ramsey, the guy who basically proved it on a dare offered to him by Keynes, is like, yeah, this is just an outline. You'd be crazy to imagine this is actually what's going on. Like, I'm not going to spell this out to the nth degree, because it would be like, you know, what you don't want to do is try and calculate this result to 97 decimals when it's only valid to two. Whereas the entire rationalist community is basically like, fuck 97 decimals, we're going to 9,000. You know what I mean? I'm not being very charitable. I understand that. But I think you lose a lot of that, whatever you want to call it, context, flavor. I think when you avoid primary sources, you run the risk of losing that. And I will say, you know, especially the farther back you go in time, like, I'm sorry, before Descartes, it's very, like, if you don't know Latin, first of all, you're not reading a math paper. I mean, it's impossible. Like it's all in plain words. They use funny terms. We don't have the symbology to articulate it in a way that like meets modern sensibility. But on the other hand, if you want to know what, now this is very mathematical, I admit, but like there's basically no clear exposition on Lebesgue integration than Lebesgue's original paper, where he justifies very clearly, like, why is this motivated? Why am I working on it? How did I come to these conclusions? What was I thinking? What problems was I tackling? Blah, blah, blah. Whereas in a textbook, you get a very technical definition that's accurate and workable, but you sort of leaves the person wondering, like, why a lot of times. Anyhow, so I'm just one point in the column of, I think primary sources are underrated, but understandable if you avoid them, especially if it's like in another language, or you go back far enough in time that it's effectively another world and the juice just isn't worth the squeeze.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, I agree, Jesse. Zeynep, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to say something very quickly just about, you know, what you said about how interesting logic is. And what personally, like, I find more interesting is the ways or the paths that the experiences through which we reach logic. And this is where, you know, people like Bergson or Jankélévitch are very important, because, for example, they show us that, you know, it's not always true formal rationalist theories. And, you know, they always, you know, criticized Kant for that. But it's really true sometimes intuition. And this is something that Bergson really worked on. And a lot of people, you know, classified as with metaphysics, but it's not just metaphysics. It's a bit beyond that, since it's through which we really reach a kind of logical thinking.
Yeah, completely. And that relates to the kind of idea that logic itself, like me, it kind of relates to actually to Peirce, I think, to some degree, about these, how these rules of logic, how they come about. And I think, yeah, I mean, I need to do more on intuition, but I have not actually read Bergson, so I'm excited to try that out. But yeah. Jesse, did you want to say anything about Peirce and logic? I saw you sent me a couple of passages from.
I'll say very briefly, I suppose. You know, he was very, I think Isabella might have said this earlier, maybe it was someone else, how, you know, he was a pioneering many things, but what today would be called like mathematical logic. So he was one of the first people to work on that very seriously. A lot of the notation we use comes from him, like the upside down A for all and the backwards Z for there exists. That's all from Peirce. And he understood what he was doing was like, how can we come up with ways of representing patterns of thought that kind of allowed us to experience what was going on more directly? So he did a lot of work on the algebraic side, but he also had a whole diagrammatic system for first order, second order, and even modal logics, where through manipulating these existential graphs, you could reach, you know, logical conclusions. And he thought of that as an actual experimental science. Like doing math in that mode turned math into an experimental science. It was an experiment on diagrams. Like, let's go hang out with these diagrams and see what happens and what we notice that was invisible to us before. So in his writing, it's like there's a self-consciousness about that. Like he understands that's why he's agonizing over like, what should these existential graphs look like? What notation should, like, he cares a lot about what notation he should use. I'm always sort of bummed because there's this whole tools for thought universe that his thinking isn't more talked about there, because he was very much, you know, how can we represent problems in a way that make them amenable to different approaches? That's all I'll say about Peirce. Almost
appears. Yeah, I'm really enjoying reading him. And yeah, I guess he was also extremely involved in making observations as well. So going back to the point about, you know, the practicality of thinking, mm-hmm. even though he's engaged at a metaphysical level, he's also very much engaged at the physical level, right?
Yeah, like he built, he worked for what is now the U.S. Geological Survey and built a device that was... His job was to go from like station to station, measuring the strength of gravity at different places in the United States. And he built this pendulum that I think until the early mid 20th century was like the most accurate way we had of kind of measuring the strength of gravity. So I forget who said it, but it was sort of like, he's what you would get if, you know, Hegel worked in a lab. Like if Hegel were a laboratory, he'd be a Peirce. I forget who framed it that way. But yeah, he was very sensitive to like, yes, there's a clarity to mathematical thought, but like anyone who has ever tried to measure a beam of wood, let alone do serious laboratory science where you care about things to the 10th decimal place, do they understand how difficult and therefore impossible like actual certainty is? And so we sort of have to start from where we are. Is the, you know, start from wherever we find ourselves is a phrase he uses over and over again.
Yeah, I love that. And there's, I'm going to misquote it, but I think there's something Schrödinger says in What Is Life, where he basically says, like, if the man on the street understood how probabilistic physics was, he would be afraid to sit in a chair or something like that. But I wanted to, just thank everyone for coming and speaking and listening. I would also love to do more of this. So, if anyone, I don't know, has any last thoughts, or would also love to hear from you in DMs if anyone wants to do one of these in the future, because I think they could be quite fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. I would be more than happy to do a space with you on any of this stuff at any time. That sounds rather arrogant. I don't mean it to be. I just was sort of offering it because I also wanted to have one last opportunity to say something. Now, you guys probably know this. Certainly the gentleman who was just speaking about Peirce. But there was this kind of back and forth between William James and Peirce about the name pragmatism. I think it was Peirce who said this, but who knows, it might have been James. American philosophy is one of my weaker areas. But he said he was going to rename it instead of pragmatism. He said he's going to rename it pragmaticism so that it's so ugly nobody else would want to steal it again, because he just didn't want the name being stolen again. So I always think that's kind of a funny sort of way to end discussions of the American philosophers there.
That's great. Yeah, so please do DM Brian and get a sense of, I mean, if this time also works for lots of people, I think it's a great time. Maybe we can do some experiments about timing and make sure that we can grab as many people who are interested as possible and keep chatting.
Yeah, thank you all. And I would love to do this again.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. I'm looking forward to be listening to more of these.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Jesse. Thanks, Sylvia.
Appreciate you showing up.
Have a good one.